Slow Burn Media, an evergreen podcast, presents Who Killed? A podcast that provides a voice for the voiceless. Hello and welcome to episode 136 of Who Killed? I am your host, Bill Huffman, and this is a Slow Burn Media, an evergreen podcast production. On this week's show, we are going to take a look back at a case from 1978. But before we get started, I want to talk about what I participated in on Wednesday, October 27th, and that was the Walk for Amy. And this was in honor of 10-year-old Amy Mihaljevic, who was abducted from the Bay Village Shopping Plaza in Bay Village, Ohio, on October 27th, 1989. I was a 10-year-old and was living in the city that borders Bay, and it was something that was extremely tragic and definitely hit close to home because, of course, these are small suburbs and everybody's parents were extremely worried that they were going to be the next abducted child. And again, this case is still unsolved. And what makes her case unique is that she was actually lured to the plaza. And so this was a premeditated act. This was not some abduction of opportunity. This was something that was planned. And again, unfortunately, she was found dead about 100 days after she went missing. So the Walk for Amy was in honor of Amy Mihaljevic and her family and the community. And we all hope one day that we'll be able to find the answers to the case that has haunted Northeast Ohio for a number of years. But there's another case that has also haunted Northeast Ohio for a number of years, and that is the missing persons case of Judy Martins. And she was from Avon Lake, but was going to Kent State University at the time of her disappearance. In order to make heads and tails of this case, I have a special guest on this week's episode. And again, that is Nick from the True Crime Garage podcast. They've actually recently done an episode on this case, so Nick knows a little bit about it. And again, it's always a pleasure to have Nick on the show. Hey, Nick. Great to have you back on the show. How are you doing, man?
Wonderful, Bill. Thanks for having me on. I'm doing a little working from home today, so to be able to sit here and chat with you and be on the Slow Burn Media flagship show, Who Killed? Well, it's a dream come true, my friend.
Well, it's always a dream come true when you are on Who Killed. So the listeners will be thrilled. And of course, we are here to talk about true crime. And of course, you're the co-host of True Crime Garage, the best true crime podcast out there. And you are, you are what, almost 500 episodes in?
530.
Holy cow.
We'll come out, number 530 will come out this week. And we also do a show called Off the Record, which we are over like 130 of those as well. That's our Stitcher Premium show that people can sign up for. You can figure that out by going to truecrimegarage.com. We got a link on there, and you actually get your first month for free if you want to sign up for Off the Record. So I always recommend go sign up for free, listen to it for 30 days. You could probably binge the hell out of it and get as many episodes in as you want. And if you want, cancel. Who cares, right? Try it out. Take the old Pepsi challenge and see if you like Off the Record.
Take Nick's advice. He always has positive things to say. And, you know, being a mentor in this industry, he's been very helpful along the way. And I'm going to talk about a certain case today that I think Nick knows a little bit about. And that is the case of one Judy Martins. And she was 22 years old on May 24th, 1978. And she was a junior at Kent State University and was a major in women's studies. Now, she was last seen walking from her friend's dorm, which was Dunbar Hall. And she lived only 300 yards away in Engelman Hall. And this was around 2 a.m. Now, Martins was never seen again. So that's an interesting question right off the bat. Nick, what's your thought about Judy Martins walking 300 yards between dorms in the middle of the night and pretty much disappearing from the face of the earth.
Well, yeah, there's a very short distance between Dunbar Hall and Engelman Hall, and it was, there's a little discrepancy there through some of the different reports that I've seen. Some have it as many as 300 yards, some as little as 100 yards, which is even scarier. From my understanding, the campus, the Kent State University campus, has changed dramatically since, when did this case take place? 1978. So yes. Yeah, obviously it's grown by leaps and bounds since then. And back in 78, look, the issue with this case has been a couple of things. There are reasons, right? When we look at these unsolved cases, there are always reasons why they are unsolved. Not that we are handing out any blame here, but in this particular case, the 24th was a day before a break. Okay, mm-hmm. So most of the kids, you know, 20, 21, 22-year-old kids, they're leaving campus on the 24th or on the 25th. So she goes missing, and it's going to take a little bit of time to notice that she's even missing, because Judy, she lived by herself. So when you live by yourself and you don't have any class that you're supposed to attend that morning or that day, it takes a little bit of time for people to notice that, hey, where is she? So by the time she's reported missing, a lot of the kids had left campus for one reason or another. Again, they're on break. And this is going to kind of hinder the investigation, if you really want to call it that. It looks to me more like it's campus police kind of checking on a student. And how often are they doing that, right? I mean, 5, 6, maybe a dozen times a week that they're checking on a student that didn't come home. And actually, I had found some statements from the police chief, the local police chief, who was talking about the Martins case years after the fact and saying, look, all the time that I was there, we were getting a ton of missing persons reports that would come in. And almost every single time, it was just as simple as, kid decided to go home, you know, to mom and dad's place, leave the campus for whatever reason and didn't tell anybody, or girl stayed at boyfriend's house, or boyfriend stayed at girl's house or dorm or crashed somewhere and turned up the next day. So this was something that was really difficult for them, because she goes missing, and this is really the only person in the course of years and years and years of this police chief working there that she goes missing, and then they never see her again. They never find her, locate her in any of the cases that they had ever had leading up to that. And beyond that, they had always found the person, and many times within just a few hours. So we get a difficult case here because, one, there's delay in knowing that she's missing to report it. So before anybody's even looking for her, there's delay. And then two, once we go around and start asking questions, hey, who saw her? Where was she last? What was she wearing? Those typical questions, where may she be? By the time you're going around and you have the local PD asking those questions, well, a lot of the people were already gone from the campus. So that's going to really kind of screw up your investigation as well. She was supposed to go on some kind of trip.
Yeah. Yeah. She was supposed to go to New York with two of her friends.
Yeah. And one kind of thing that's a little confusing here in this case as well is that there's really kind of two different stories of the knowing that she's missing. Okay, so one version has it that she was to go home to her mom and dad's house in Avon Lake and pick up a vehicle, that this would be a new vehicle for her that I believe her parents purchased for her. That was the story from the family. Now, the story from the friends and PD was that she was to go on this trip and this would be with a couple of her girlfriends, go out to New York for kind of like a long weekend, and doesn't show when they're supposed to leave for that trip. So they notice something's wrong. I don't want to confuse anyone, because I want to be clear here. There's very likelihood that both stories could be accurate, that she was going to pick up a vehicle at some point on that long weekend and also go on that trip as well. So, but one thing I didn't speak with any of the family in this case. Sadly, going off of memory here, Bill, I believe both of her parents are probably deceased by this point. I know her father is. And she does have a sister, which I believe might even be more in my neck of the woods. But I did just kind of voice it on True Crime Garage that, look, one story's coming from the family, one story's coming from PD. If maybe what we need to do here in the Martin's case is fill in some of the blanks. And if this is information that is incorrect or wrong or could be added to what the police currently know, then I'm hoping that that her sister and the investigating agency are in communication with one another. And I want to be clear about something here, too, that's very interesting in this case. She disappeared in 1978. This is very much an active investigation. I can say that 110%, which is strange for a missing persons case this old.
The question that I have about Memorial Day weekend, and I wonder if this was just something that was in the 70s, if they were on quarters or semesters, because if they were on semesters, there would be a lot less students on campus because school would have already been let out at that point. For the spring. And if she was staying for the summer, then they would have been, that would have been why she was staying there. And that, you know, summer classes are always less full and campus is not as busy. But I am not, do you know anything about that? Do you know if were they on quarters or semesters? Do you know?
No, I don't know. But from my understanding, when school would be out for the summertime, in the past year, she had always gone back home and stayed with mom and dad in Avon Lake.
Okay. Yeah, and Avon Lake, you know, for the listeners, is only... I've lived in Avon Lake before. About 5 years of my life I spent there. And, it's...
about an hour drive, you would say, from Kent State to Avon Lake?
Yes, it's about an hour drive, and it's coincidentally bumps right up to Bay Village, which is... obviously a place that's near and dear. And, she grew up in Avon Lake, and the whole thing about them not reporting her missing. I mean, that really is where I think the whole investigation kind of hits a speed bump, right off the bat. I mean, when you're not finding somebody or going after, like, if you don't even realize that somebody is considered missing until a few days have already gone by. I mean, what do they say? The first 48, you know, the first 48 hours are the most important. And those 48 hours were not even being, you know, investigated. I would say that her killer had a pretty good getaway time frame. And again, that's just so weird that she would be... I'm so confused on the fact that she would disappear in such a short walk from her dorm, you know, from the dorms. I mean, it's just so weird. And I just think that Judy herself, I mean, she was, I'd mentioned before, she was a major in women's studies, but she was also an art major. And one of the things that I saw that she was wearing when she disappeared was a red wig that they were just kind of goofing around with. And, you know, it just kind of brings you the innocence to understand what is going on here. I mean, this is just a 22-year-old girl. She's an RA. I mean, clearly a responsible person. I mean, if you're an RA at college, you are generally not the party girl. That's just the way that I've always seen it. When I was in school, the RA was always the responsible one. That's the person you go to for help in any situation. So she was clearly responsible. Now, she also, when she went missing and they did finally go into her, her dorm room, all of her belongings were still there. Like, none of them, she had no money missing. She didn't have any of her makeup was still there. I mean, it didn't look like she had taken off, and nobody thought that she would be, a runaway or anything like that. I mean, do you think there's any chance that she could have just decided to pick up and leave? You've talked about the Brian
Schaefer
case in Columbus, and that's an interesting case too. And he's never been seen again as well. I mean, is there any chance in your mind that she could have just decided to pick up and leave?
Well, I don't want to squash the rest of the story for you, but zero. I would put that number at zero for Judy Martins. And from what I've been told by, this is secondhand information, but maybe even third-hand information if we're being spot on here. But Judy was, in my mind, the perfect college student, okay? You're right about what you said about her being responsible. She absolutely was responsible. But what I mean by my vision of the perfect college student would be Judy. Like, she could be the life of the party. Mm-hmm. She could be the most entertaining, outgoing person when she didn't have to be responsible. You know, when it came to her responsibilities and her duties and her schoolwork and her classes and working toward her degree, everybody says she was right on. There was no one better. Like, she was committed and she was responsible. But when it came to being outgoing and being the life of the party, she could do that. She could flip that switch, and a lot of people can't. And that's something that she could do, and that's why I think she was such a likable person. She was a person that had many, many friends. She was very popular. And you're right. The confusion here, as I pointed out, and as you're understanding, is the lapse of time has really kind of messed up this case. There's also a lot of weird stuff on this case as far as when you look at it from all of these years later, right? When you look at it 40 years later, it takes on a different appearance than what it had in 78, 79, and 80. So when people fire up the old internet machine and get looking at this case, the first thing you're going to see is a photo of Martins, and she's smiling, good looking college kid. But the strange thing is she is kind of wearing a costume that night. Almost. She's wearing a red wig and mm-hmm. she's dressing herself up. And from the people that saw her that night, one thing that I found fascinating about this case was everyone kind of kept using the same word, which was bizarro to me. They kept saying, yeah, she was kind of dressed like a hooker. Or sometimes she would dress like a hooker. Now, what I kind of took from that, Bill, was that I think that that was maybe even her words, that this was like a getup that she would put on to go out and party. Now,
like, this is my hooker. This is my hooker look.
Right. But the weird thing to me is exactly, because the weird thing to me is when you see that outfit and when you see how she was dressed that night, it's not Julia Roberts, pretty woman standing on the street corner hooker, right? This is like a plaid shirt and some weird jeans and a red wig.
This is more like the Skid Row type of hooker.
Well, no, I wouldn't even say that. Like, I don't even understand using that word. Okay, and I want to be clear here. I do think that was her word or her friend's words. These are not mine.
Sure.
To me, it looks to me more like a you know, small town girl from a nice area, and that's about where her mind goes when she thinks of a hooker, like or how one would dress, how a sex worker would dress. So, but that statement kept coming up with any of these people that saw her that night. Now, what I think is bizarre about this case is that when you review it 40 years later, almost all of the missing persons posters, flyers, and online information about her features the photo taken from that night where she's wearing this wig. So she doesn't actually even look the way that she actually looked. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
How weird that is. Like, you're going to put out a picture of how one looks over and over again to try to get some information to, has anybody seen this person? Well, the one that goes around today is primarily a picture of her wearing a wig and smiling and wearing a bunch of makeup. And she's a beautiful young woman. But doesn't look naturally, does not look the way she looked that night when she went missing. And the other thing that's tricky here too, is you say May 24th, but let's be clear. The whole evening starts on May 23rd. She goes out to dinner with some friends, and then she's going to go party and hang out with some of her friends at this, which one of the dorms was it that she was hanging out at? Was it Dunbar?
She was at Dunbar, and she was going back to Engelman, I think.
So Dunbar Hall was an all-male dorm, and her dorm, that Engelman, was an all-female dorm. And so she was over kind of hanging out with some male friends that she had. These are people that she's known for quite some time. And from my understanding, the way that the timeline plays out and the events of that night, she's kind of hopping from dorm to dorm and going around and kind of talking to these different guys that she knows. And in some cases, there might be one guy there or two guys there. But... you know, most of the information online will say that she went missing on May 24th, and that's all fine and well and good and everything, but the reality of it is we don't know exactly what hour she went missing by. So to say that at 2 a.m. she was walking from dorm A to dorm B and somebody grabbed her or she vanished in that short walk in the middle of the night is... a bit of a, you know, it's a good story to tell, but it's probably not factual.
Mm-hmm.
Something happened through the course of her night with people that she knew. And that is what has ultimately led to her disappearance, not this walk from dorm to dorm. And so something happened late on the 23rd, early on the 24th, and then she's not reported missing until 2 days later on May 26th at 4:35 p.m. And she's reported missing by one of her friends. Again, she was supposed to go on that trip. Her friend, God bless her, was smart enough to notify Martin's parents as well. And God bless them. They were smart enough that they reported her missing in Avon Lake as well. So this is something that I would recommend anybody out there doing. God forbid any of us find ourselves in this type of predicament. But if you have a loved one that comes up missing and they are in another location, but they are from another location, report them missing in any location that they will accept the report. Just file those reports. Because what happened in this case is Kent State didn't know what the hell they were doing.
Yes.
They didn't know how to investigate this. And, you know, I don't want to throw too much blame and fault on them. They're a campus PD, basically, right? They're there to break up beer parties and catch people smoking joints. That's primarily what they are doing out there. The reason why this case has stayed alive for all of these years, and the reason why you and I are sitting here talking about it today, is Avon Lake continued to pursue this case for quite some time and did a good amount of work on the Judy Martin's case. And so my hat goes off to her friend and her parents and family for going the extra step, reporting her missing in multiple jurisdictions and keeping the case alive themselves. And her friends are still, we're talking 40 years later, Bill, they're still devastated. That's what kind of person she was. They're still devastated.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
By the loss of their friend all of these decades later, and every one of them had such wonderful things to say about this young woman.
You know, it's really sad to see how basically the family they've never had any answers. The parents have passed away. The interesting thing that I've seen in the research, and I can see where the confusion comes in about what her plans were for the weekend, because you do see reports of, she was going to go home that weekend, you know, according to her siblings, but, you know, according to her friends, they were going to New York. So yeah, there are different theories on that particular, what she was actually going to be doing that weekend. So I'm a little interested in getting some clarity on that, but it is definitely important for a family like Judy's to do exactly what you just said, and that is report her missing in multiple jurisdictions, because then you get kind of all hands on deck. And not that the thing about 1978, which is also, it's just that era, man. Like, I hate to say it, but like, people did kind of just sort of disappear every once in a while and then come back, but she just wasn't that type of person. That's where this case hinges on. You know, I think police, the Kent State Police, you know, you see some reports where, you know, the family met with the president, you know, a week after the disappearance, and, you know, they left the meeting unimpressed, thinking, you know, they were just doing a kind of like a PR job trying to cover, you know, their tracks. And, you know, clearly there was something that happened at Kent State that they were still trying to recover from. But again, it is a drop of the ball by authorities when they just make assumptions off the bat. You know, again, like, okay, she's missing, but again, how much did the Kent State Police take that seriously? I think, like you said, the Avon Lake Police took it a lot more seriously, because they're not a college town. They're a suburb of Cleveland, and you know what? They've got time and cops that aren't there to break up beer parties, and you know, they're not campus police, man. I mean, it's just, they're real police. Not to say that campus police aren't real police, which I kind of just did, but I didn't mean to. You know, it's just more of like,
I think it depends on the location, and it depends on the department.
True.
And probably the time that we're talking about here too. And
true.
I think a big key of this is 1978, as you said, the time frame that we're talking about. And yeah, Avon Lake certainly took this a little more seriously. And I say that word because I don't know a better substitute. I just don't think that Kent State knew what it was that they were looking at. I don't think that they understood how to even conduct this type of investigation because of the lay of the land. A college is a natural place for people to disappear, and not for nefarious reasons. They disappear because they ain't liking school so much and they decide to go home, or they jump ship at some point and decide to go off. And, you know, young adults are impulsive, and we've all been there and we've all done that. And I can understand the campus police going, this probably really isn't anything here. And, oh, even if it is, we really don't know what to do with it. So, like, one thing in particular, when you referenced her dorm room, and look, her parents would be terrified to know and be told early on in this case that, yeah, we went into her dorm and it didn't look like anything was missing. You know, and she had eyeglasses and things, purse and things that, that her family says she would have taken with her had she chose to go somewhere. And those items were still left behind in her dorm room. One thing that I find fascinating about this case, though, too, while we're talking about items and possessions, is from my understanding, Bill, you know, she's wearing a particular getup that night. This is the weird case where you can actually see. You can see what the person was wearing on the last night that anyone is saying that they saw her alive and well. Most of the time, that's not the case. Most of the time, you're getting a picture of somebody with the description of what they were wearing or what their belongings were at the time that they were believed to last have been seen. So here we get the images on her. You know, we get that wig, we get the getup. I think she even had some kind of costume type dress, or not dress, but purse with her that night. And nowhere in the Kent State investigation or the Avon Lake investigation have they said that they found any of these items as well. And when I say that this case is an active investigation, I want to assure you it very much is, which makes me feel good, because oftentimes 40 years into a case, they're not active at all. This one very much is active, but we need to be pointing out to the listeners here, so that there's no confusion about it. We're not looking for Judy Martin's at this time, unfortunately. We're looking for her remains. And this case is really at a standstill until her body is, or remains are recovered.
Now, I did see that her brother and her sister both submitted their DNA to the national database, you know, in case there is a missing or unidentified body that is recovered. So at least there is definitely, and again, that just happened. I mean, I think they did that in the past few years, but still, I mean, that's like, clearly they're still involved, and clearly there are people still interested in seeing resolution to this case. Back to the campus police, you also have to wonder how many people were, because it was a holiday weekend, did they have more people on staff, or did they have less people on staff because of the holiday? And if it was less people, then, you know, how many people do you have to investigate a possible missing persons? But again, it's college, and it is not even that, it's not even an insult to say they may have been like, well, she'll turn up, you know, like, I can see, because there's no blood, there's no sign of a struggle, there's no evidence that a crime had been committed other than the circumstantial fact that her belongings were still there, the fact that she wore contact lenses and her eyeglasses were left behind, and the fact that she, you know, didn't show up where she was supposed to be. But those are all things that don't point to necessarily a crime, especially if that's not what you're thinking about as a campus police officer in 1978. Serial killings and stuff like that, I mean, I know that was in the era of Ted Bundy and all that, but were they thinking like that? I mean, it doesn't sound like it. I mean, at least from my perspective of the research, it doesn't look like they took it as seriously as they could have. But I'm also not going to knock them for that, because, like you said, college is a great place for people just to kind of tune in and drop out, you know? It's just... Mm-hmm. But it's just... It leads you to wonder about that ex-boyfriend, because we haven't talked about that yet. And...
Yeah.
We have Judy, who was in a long-term relationship of, from what I've seen, 5 years, which would have overlapped from high school, I'm assuming. And apparently he passed a polygraph test with the Avon Lake Police. So there you go, and you can see that the Avon Lake Police are the ones conducting the polygraph tests. You know, again, it's the Avon Lake, I think the fact that the family is from there, the parents are there, I think that they had a little bit more of a drive to find the answers for the Martins family, because it really is, it does seem like they were the more involved police department.
Yeah, 100%. And my guess here is, look, they lived in Avon Lake and Judy grew up there. And so there's a chance they either personally knew an officer or a detective, or, you know, just know each other from growing up or living in the same tight-knit community. And part of that, though, too, Bill, is so Jim Young is or was Martin's boyfriend.
Okay.
And so he was still living in or near Avon Lake. You know, she grew up there. They were boyfriend, girlfriend from high school. Now, we should be clear here, because when you say, hey, they had a 5-year relationship and she's a popular girl at Kent State, and then they break up and she goes missing. Wow, that looks like, oh, this guy came into town and did something terrible. It's only an hour's drive. That's always a possibility. That's something that you're going to look at. But when we looked into that angle a little closer, one thing that we found was the dynamics of the relationship itself. It's easy to say it was a 5-year relationship. The truth of it was a very much on again, off again relationship for 5 years. As anyone that's had a high school, high school love, if you want to call that, and college love, can imagine how those things work. From my understanding is she actually attended two colleges. So Kent State was her second college, and the two of them, and I can't recall what the first one was.
No,
maybe
she was
OU.
Like me. She left OU.
Okay. She left OU. Jim Young, from my understanding, attended OU with her for some of that time. So
she was there for
that's
2 years.
Yep. That's why the relationship carries over from high school to college. Now, Jim Young goes back to Avon Lake, and she then decides to start going to Kent State. They were on again, off again, and from everything I could find, and this is what her friends were saying too, because, you know, she's relaying this information to her friends, that it was kind of one of those things that when she goes home for the summer, her and Jim hang out a lot during the summertime. Mm-hmm. And then when she goes back to school, they hang out maybe once or twice a month, but not so much. And Jim's an interesting cat to me, and I kind of see why they... I don't know if cleared is the right word to use with Jim Young, but he was definitely a suspect early on. As you can see, they gave him a polygraph and they interviewed him several times. But I found some the transcript from one of the interviews, and I guess the only legal trouble he had at the time. So part of the reason for their breakup was he liked to drink. He was a bit of a party guy. Yeah, she liked to have a good time, but she was a little more driven. She was working on school. She was working on building her life. And the only legal trouble I could find for him was he fired a gun in the store. There's a few different stories here, but the way it sounds to me, Bill, is that he fired a gun inside his apartment and either shot out a window or shot a wall on accident. He could have been drunk, I don't know. But one part that was a little funny in the transcripts of the police interview with Jim Young was they ask him, they're like, hey, do you have any guns? And he goes, yeah, you guys know that I have guns. I was arrested for shooting out the window in my apartment. Like, he's very forthcoming. And
they
go, okay.
Cleaning the gun. It probably went off.
Well, listen to this. He goes, they go, okay, well, where are your guns? He goes, well, you know I have guns because you guys confiscated them when you charged me with with firing this gun in the city limits. So he was still waiting to go to court for whatever those charges were, you know, very misdemeanor type stuff. But his guns that he openly tells the police, yeah, I have guns and firearms, but they're in your possession because I'm waiting to go to court for these charges. So, and you referenced serial killer, and I'm imagining that you, in your research there, you came across probably the name of a serial killer that has been tied to
Posey.
This case. Yeah.
Yes. And that would be one William John Posey Jr. And he had lived actually just about 10 minutes from the Kent State University campus. And one of the interesting things about Mr. Posey is that he pleaded guilty to the abduction and murder of an Illinois woman. And I just said Illinois. Illinois woman. He was convicted of the kidnapping of Iris Brown in 1981. Now, Brown, who disappeared in 1976, was never located. Now, that sounds familiar. This is from the Charlie Project. In 2008, Posey admitted he had murdered her. He never faced charges in the Martins' case, but is considered a person of interest due to his criminal history and his proximity to where she disappeared. And I cannot disagree with that one bit. What are the chances of Judy living, I don't know, within a 10-minute drive of a serial killer? I mean, I guess it's possible that he wasn't involved, but what are your thoughts on this interesting character?
So in that profile of him, how many people did it say that he killed? Was it two or one?
You know, I think he got convicted of one.
Because I think at a later date
he confessed. Yeah, he's done.
To another murder.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think he was ever charged with it, but I think he admitted to another murder.
Okay, and so the reason why he was never really charged with the other one, I think he was actually charged and convicted of the one victim's kidnapping, mm-hmm. but never of her murder. And then later he confessed to, he's like, yeah, I killed her. So William Posey's an interesting cat. As you said, he lives in or near Avon Lake at the time that Martins goes missing.
Near Kent.
Yeah, near Kent, I'm sorry. And so, is there a chance that he's, you know, the random killer that you're looking for, and it's a random attack, and he just kind of snatches her up on the way home, on her walk home? She's walking home by herself in the middle of the night, attractive young college student. Yeah, there's a possibility. I would put the possibility at very somewhere in the margins of slim to none. And I state that simply because the Martins case is an active investigation. The current agency that is working this case is not Kent State so much, not Avon Lake so much. It's the U.S. Marshals, okay? And this is a pretty top-notch organization right here. You don't mess with the Marshals. Now, the Marshals became involved in the Martins case because of William Posey. So if you look, his victims were in different states, okay? And that's part of the reason why the U.S. Marshals had to get involved. Now, the U.S. Marshals get involved, and they're starting to hear these rumors of, oh, well, he was in the area at the time that Martins went missing, and, oh, we believe he has another victim that he kidnapped, and her body's never been located. But the reason why he was never officially convicted of the murder, only the kidnapping of the one victim, is because he confessed all these years later to this murder. He was terminally ill. This was essentially a deathbed confession. This dude was not a great guy. Obviously, he murdered two women. But when we say kidnapped, if you look at those two cases, they're quite different than the Martins case. Both of those victims had the unfortunate commonality of knowing William Posey. These weren't random victims that he snatched up somewhere. These were people that he knew and that he killed. He's one of the rare types of serial killers that kill people that they know. And so he killed these two different young women. You know, so Martin's kind of fits the victimology profile for this Posey guy, but he's making a deathbed confession. What is a deathbed confession? Deathbed confession is you're trying to get right with God before you have to die. Because if you didn't receive proper punishment here, you might be getting it at the next place that you go to. And Posey wanted to try to get right. And so my guess here, Bill, is if Posey was our guy, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about an unsolved Martin's case. He would have confessed to it. And he basically said, he was questioned about it. And he said, I did these other ones. I didn't do this one. And he has no reason to not confess to this one. And in fact, in the one girl's case where they never found the remains, he physically actively tried to help them locate the remains. They just, due to the time that has gone by, were unable to do so. And so Posey's an interesting part of the story, but he's just that, an interesting part of this story. Another interesting part to the story is the claims that she was alive and well.
Oh, yeah.
And decided to start living on the streets and become a street worker, sex worker herself in the greater Cleveland area.
Yeah, I saw that theory. I'm like, what? That seems like a far-fetched. The more I looked into that, that was a very interesting lead, because wasn't it her brother that went up and actually tracked down this particular person?
On everybody's mind on the local level. We're talking early 80s. The newspapers were still a big deal back then. And so this was a story that most people read. And one night, a working girl gets booked in the Cleveland jail, comes in. She looks somewhat like Miss Martin's. And so somebody phones in at a tip and says, hey, I think we arrested the girl that's been missing for all these years. And so they get up there and they start talking to this girl, and she does not deny being Judy Martin's. So that's going to start a whole weird part to this story. But the family ends up meeting this young woman and says, you know, they felt bad for her. And it's weird because it sounds to me what adds to the public's confusion on this case is that the early reports state that Judy's mother said that, yes, this is Judy. And her brother and father are like, nope, it's not. And sometimes, look, love is blind, my friend. We all know that. And when you are hurting, when you are heartbroken, you will see things and do things and wish for things so badly to be true, and almost try to will them into existence. But, you know, it's really a tragic story all around, because you talked about her family and the brother and sister giving their DNA, providing DNA to law enforcement. And this is because, you're absolutely right, Bill, they got no answers in this case for 40 years. No answers. All they ended up getting was some additional questions and then additional heartbreak. And this young woman that was picked up in Cleveland was unfortunately drug addicted, and just another sad part to the story. But it didn't really have anything to do with Judy Martin's. And that's just like layer and layer of heartbreak for her family to get these near misses, right, on what could be. And there's been several Jane Does throughout the years that they thought may be Martin's, and it has not been yet. It has not turned out to be that way yet. So it's a really tragic, heartbreaking case, and it's one of those ones to me that I feel really bad for the family, because not only was their daughter and sister missing, but then you get these additional gut punches every now and then, every few years of a Jane Doe or this young woman that was picked up in Cleveland. That's could be, but it's not, you know, just another blow to the heart there.
And that is all the time that we have for this week's episode. So many thanks to Nick from the True Crime Garage podcast for joining me. And again, part two will conclude next week, next Friday. As always, I drop new episodes on Fridays. And if you guys enjoy this podcast, you can help support the show by using my PayPal username at WilliamHuffman3, or you can do it via the Venmo app with my username at Bill-Huffman-3. Now, every contribution, big or small, does help keep these shows on the air. Now, you can help support the show by leaving a 5-star review as well on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you listen to your favorite shows. Now, those 5 stars do help keep the important cases that I cover, such as Amy's, in the spotlight. And again, if you want to stay up to date on the cases that I have covered, as well as the new shows that I have coming down the pipeline, please follow me on Twitter at BillHuffman3. So thank you guys so much again for listening. And as always, until next time, be healthy and stay safe.
Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Paul Brandis introducing my podcast, Countdown to Dallas. It's a fascinating, in-depth look at the seemingly unconnected events that led to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's based on my book of the same title. In that book and in this podcast, I go all the way back to 1939, when Lee Harvey Oswald was born into a troubled and dysfunctional family. I'll follow his transient and often violent teenage years and young adulthood, painting a fuller picture of the man who would later become Kennedy's killer. I also take a look at events unfolding in that era, like Cuba and Vietnam, and I'll unpack the conspiracy theories too, not one of which has ever been conclusively proven. Subscribe to Countdown to Dallas at evergreenpodcasts.com or your favorite listening app, October 31st.
Hello, this is Dr. Grande, the host of True Crime Psychology and Personality. On my podcast, I explore and explain the pathology behind some of the most horrendous crimes and those who commit them. We discuss topics like narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy, and antisocial personality disorder from a scientifically informed perspective. What is a narcissist? How do you spot a sociopath? What signs can you look for to protect yourself from these dangerous personalities? It's not just about the stories, but also the science and psychology behind them. So if you're interested in true crime or mental health, I'd encourage you to give my show a listen wherever you get podcasts.